Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio for this Thursday. We're normally out and about on a Friday, so it's all a little bit discombobulating, but we've sorted everything out now. We're broadcasting live from a special event. It's Donegal Giving, and it's being hosted here at On Green On Theatre. And there is a brilliant lineup here of community and business leaders, and they're here to share their thoughts and insights on what giving really means to the individuals, to the workplace, and to the wider community. And we talked already to the two keynote speakers, namely Sylvester Clancy and Caroline Faulkner, and that in and of itself is an interesting story of giving, because Caroline, at the beginning, or early at least in Sylvester's career, was gave him guidance and mentorship, and now he's an incredibly successful man himself as executive director of Fintru. And then you've got someone like Caroline Faulkner, who's been involved in some of the biggest companies in the world, seeing the benefit of coming back to Donegal and you know, having those connections, etc. So Donegal Giving is all about celebrating the giving that already exists across our county and inspiring even more of it. We talked yesterday about the establishment of a business network for men. That falls into this sort of space as well. Right, some of your texts and WhatsApps and calls coming in so far this morning. Greg, not only moved the cars at Maharoti for painting, but all the old boats and rubbish that's all lying around so that the local residents can enjoy the space as well. A caller asks, why don't the council do all these roadworks in the summertime when it's daylight until 10 p.m? Is it they hold on to money until almost the end of the year and have to try and spend it all in the last 2 months? Someone from the council should be brought on your show to answer these questions, because this situation is completely and utterly disastrous, and it goes on every year at this time. There is a second tranche of funding that's given later in the year by government for certain road works, but also too, in terms of the work happening in Letterkenny at the moment, for an example, this is a different tranche of funding, active travel funding as well, which they're looking to spend. But listen, I think a lot of people would agree with you that it doesn't feel like common sense. Another caller says, lovely to hear Caroline and Sylvester on this morning. I remember them both fondly from Primerica, and the work they've done in employing IT professionals in Donegal is immense. Continuing on the work that the IDA did in bringing these IT companies to the area. Morning, Greg. Can you say a big thank you to all the Fintru volunteers? It means a lot to the hospice, and they're so helpful. That comes in from our friend Isabel and all at the hospice. And it's lovely, Isabel, to hear from you on the receiving end of that initiative, that generosity. Let me see. Please announce that there are sheep wandering on the road in the Tullybeg area of Church Hill. Red markings on them. And this listener wants to advise the farmer and also travellers in the area that they could cause a collision. So it might be useful information for the sheep owner. They're wandering in the Tullybeg area of Church Hill. I'm involved in... I'm going to be sort of emceeing our... we have a guest, a seat here for guests. It's being used as a makeshift coat rack at the moment, but anyway, we'll get that cleared. Now, I'm involved in emceeing a event in Donegal Town tonight in the Central Hotel, involving the likes of Airgrid, the ESB, the SEAI, etc. It's about, you know, if you wanted to convert your house, or you know, what Airgrid are doing to improve the network infrastructure, what the ESB is doing to make the system more resilient, etc., etc. It is a free event. It kicks off tonight at 7:30. So if you're in and around Donegal Town, sorry, it kicks off at 6 o'clock with loads of stands and all that type of stuff. So if you want to get along to that, it's not too late to go. I understand there's quite a lot of people registered already, but you can. It's in the beautiful Central Hotel in Donegal Town. Now, some requests before we move on in the program. Can you please wish a very happy birthday to Susan Everson in Milford? That comes in from Mary. Happy birthday, Susan. Happy 70th birthday to Susan Evanson. Another one for you. This time it's from your sisters Bernie, your husband Mickey, and goddaughter Dina. I think it's Dina, D-I-N-A-H. It sounds like a nice name. Happy 5th birthday to Ryan McMonagall. Lots of love and good wishes, and enjoy your day from Granny and Grandad Gallagher 5. And that's it. Keep them coming into us. Your comments, whatever you want to talk about. We've got loads more guests lined up. I think actually we have a bit of live music here as well, live from On Green On Theatre. Coming up a little later on, we're going to be getting more information on a significant tightening up of rules as it relates to learner drivers. We're going to speak to a gentleman who I bumped into at another outside broadcast. We were at Dunfanaghy Golf Club, and he was part of a brilliant band that were playing there on that day. And he said to me that day that he was doing a fundraiser for he was doing, I'll tell you, I don't want to paraphrase it, we'll talk to him about that. So I'm going to talk to him a little bit about that. And it's in memory of his wife. It's Stephen Devaney, who'd be very popular. You'd know him from his music and other stuff. That and so much more besides, all coming up on the 9 till noon show. But it is Thursday, which means it's jackpot day for the bingo. And that is another Donegal giving thing, right? So it fits actually really quite perfect into this concept, because you can win lots of money, hundreds of euro a day, thousands on a Thursday, but you are giving to Vision Ireland, and your contributions are some of the greater contributions that they receive in delivering the fantastic work that they do. So an example of giving, even when sometimes you don't realise you are. So the Minister of State with Responsibility Roads for Road Safety, Sean Canney, has signed regulations to ensure learner drivers can no longer repeatedly renew their learner permits without taking a driving test. And we are joined by Minister Sean Canney on the show now. Good morning, Minister. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on, and hello to all your listeners.
Now, some of the listeners might feel like this is an old story that we're regurgitating, but really, up until now, we've been talking about the problem of this loophole. You've been expressing your desire to close it, but now we're at a point where people have a date. In other words, there is time to get your house in order, but this is happening now.
Absolutely. I signed the regulation this week, which speaks to the multiple learner permit situation. Where we have in this country over between 63 and 64,000 people who have renewed their permits more than three or more times. And of that, 22,000 are on their 10th to their 20th permit. And we have another cohort of 1,800 people who are on 20 or more permits. So what we have here is we have a situation where there are people who have learner permits. They're using them as a license. But in essence, a learner permit is not a license. Effectively, the learner permit allows you to drive on the road legally, with accompanied by a qualified driver, so that you can improve your skills before you take your test. The other side of this has been, over the years, there have been a point, if you were to, before I brought in this regulation, if you have a learner permit and you want to renew it, and you go and you get an appointment to do a test, that's the only evidence you need, and your permit is renewed. And people don't show up for the test, they just carry on. So there's thousands of people, I think last year, I think the figure I have now is about 8,500 people, or 8,500 of these appointments, there were no shows. So we have an inefficient driving test system because of these no shows. We also have people who may be on the road who shouldn't be on the road, they're there illegally. And what I'm trying to do is to clean this anomaly up. I'm encouraging people who have learner permits and have them over a continuous period of time to hone their skills, take the test, and the RSA will be contacting people as well now to let them know what they can do. Also, they will be talking to the driving instructors, explaining to him what to them what this is all about. That bottom line.
Yeah, the numbers. Yeah, there is a slight delay because I'm an outside broadcast today, Minister. But do we know why people are doing this in such great numbers? I mean, some of the statistics you gave there are startling, especially, you know, with new technology the Gardaí have in terms of, you know, checking people's insurance on the spot. You know, very, very firm. Quite a bit of enforcement and very strong penalties for driving unaccompanied, you know, significant points, cars being confiscated, etc. I mean, why is it down to so many people are illegally driving with these licenses as if they are full licenses or what?
I would say some of it is that. Interestingly, after 63,000, 64,000 learner permit holders. Over one third of them, 21,000, are living in the Dublin area. So in some cases, it could be a case that somebody got a learner permit with the objective of getting a car, but they probably didn't get the car because the public transport was in Dublin city, right? But they're still holding on to the learner permit as a what to call it, an insurance. If they ever need to get a driver's license, at least they have the permit. So they just renewed, and then they go get an appointment and renewed, and off they go again for another 2 years. So effectively, there is a bit, there's a mix in this, and I would be hoping that this regulation will flush all that out. And I would encourage people who are who don't need a learner permit to just don't be reapplying for tests to reapply, because that day is gone. But secondly, it's creating inefficiencies. And if you take people who are trying to get a driving test and their appointment is delayed, by having no shows coming into the system, it's actually creating a problem in itself. And imagine we could test an extra 8,000 people last year. The testers were there, but the people didn't show up. But there are other people who really need their license for work, for going to college, or and I often think about apprentices who are going to working on building sites, they have tools, they're going to different places, they need to have a car, and they're probably looking to get their test done, and there's a huge waiting time, or has been. So what has happened, that waiting time now has been reduced, we have additional resources in the RSA, and this is an anomaly that needs to be tackled for two reasons. Number one, make the drive testing more efficient, and secondly, make sure that people who are driving on the road are qualified to drive on the road. And it's not a question of trying to catch people out. It's a question of encouraging people to take the test and get their full license, as opposed to clogging up the system like this.
Okay, thank you very much for your time this morning. I do appreciate it. That is Minister of State with responsibility for road safety, Sean Canny. 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number if you wish to have your say in relation to that. So those new regulations come into effect from the 1st of November 2026. So that should give you, hopefully, an opportunity to be compliant. Right, okay. Nigel Sweetnam is chair of the Irish Farmers Association's National Poultry Committee, and he joins us now. Good morning, Nigel. Thank you very much for your time.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How concerning is it amongst your poultry farming members, the two most recent cases of bird flu amongst flocks of turkey?
Well, as you know, bird flu has been with us for the last 5 years, but this year is way and over and above anything that we've ever seen before. The level of anxiety out there is frightening.
What's the consequences for farmers that find, bird flu in their flock? Do they have to be destroyed? Can they be culled at that point? And is that what leads to smaller turkeys? So what does it mean for those farmers affected?
It means on a food safety basis, if you find the bird flu on your farm, as a safety precaution, all the birds are culled and they're disposed of, that they don't enter the food chain. So it's actually a wipeout situation. The other side, if you just sit back and do nothing, they'll all die in the house because it's such a virulent disease in poultry. It's also in wildlife. It's also highly dangerous in wildlife. And I was speaking recently with Birdwatch and Birdwatch Ireland, and they tell me that certain colonies of seabirds are becoming endangered because of bird flu, the amount of birds that are dying in the wild. Because this is, don't forget, this is a disease of wild birds. And what's happening here is that the commercial birds are coming in contact with wild birds and transmitting the disease. The first house of turkeys that contracted the disease were out grazing in the fields 2 weeks ago, as free-range birds do, and cross-contamination in the fields, be it through their feces or direct contact with wild birds, and that's how they contracted it. So it's a frightening time for poultry farmers because your whole livelihood is at risk. And this is people's livelihoods, and especially in the turkey trade where they get one hit in the year and this is their harvest, and these men are under ferocious pressure. The other side that's happening at the moment, I'm getting lots of phone calls from my members, are people feeling the isolation and the pressure. You're asking people not to visit you, and you're at home dealing with all this stress. So it's a very, very worrying time.
Yeah, so we can't obviously control wild birds. Can you give us the thinking behind calls for a housing order?
90% of infection occurs by direct contact with wild birds. So if you can avoid that, you've increased your chances tenfold of avoiding the disease. And that's the logic behind it, that if you keep birds indoors, they're not in contact with wild birds, and you've substantially reduced the risk. And that's why we call for it. The other side of things, over the last number of years, bird flu has been such an issue that the poultry industry now is very, very well prepared for locking their birds indoors. And we have enhanced our housing. We have enrichment now in the housing for our birds. We have extended facilities. Some people have put porches and verandas onto their houses where they're still classed as being outdoors, but they're covered and protected from wild birds. So we have the facilities, and we were calling on the minister, and we were glad that he announced it, but probably not in time. And the other thing I would say about the housing order, that it has served us very well. If we look at our track record over the last 3 years, 3 years out, 2 years out of three, we escaped untouched with bird flu by implementing these safety measures.
Just in terms of what is the norm, I presume the turkeys at the moment are for this year, right? So when normally would they be, slaughtered for human consumption? And do you think if they're of an appropriate side, farmers maybe now are edging their bets, and even if they're underweight to their expectations, going ahead with that process now, or does that not work for the farmers?
Well, I think that the traditional Christmas market is for farm fresh, oven ready turkey, and traditionally that would be killed 4 or 5 days before the presentation. Yeah. The other side is the capacity to slaughter them. Years ago, when I was growing up, we were able to kill and hang turkeys on my home farm. That's part of how I got into the poultry business. That day is long now gone with regulations, and everything must go through licensed plants and rigorous inspections, and all that is good for food safety, but it comes at a cost, and that we're relying on 3 or 4 plants to kill turkeys for Christmas, and there's probably a big issue in that as well with capacity and the danger of transporting and mixing flocks in the processing plants. But I suppose the other thing we need to think about here is farmers. This is their livelihood, and the huge pressure that this is putting on the farmers, and food security, I suppose, is a bigger issue here. It's not just turkeys, it could be table eggs tomorrow, or the real very, very important one are hatching eggs. If a farm producing hatching eggs was to contact bird flu, that's when we'd see serious problems.
All right, so just to reiterate, what are you looking for from the Agriculture Minister now, and how urgent is your call?
We're looking for a disease fund to be put in place, and we have done preparatory work with them, and the Minister for Finance did make a provision in the budget for it to the Department of Agriculture, and we're looking for that to be acted upon and put in place, that because it's not just bird flu, there's a host of diseases out there that can wreak havoc on poultry farmers, and we're looking for a fund to be put in place where the department would put a pot in place, and we as farmers would co-finance the running of the scheme between industry, government and farmers. That has to happen as a matter of urgency, because it's bird flu today, it could be salmonella tomorrow, it could be Merrick's disease down the road, and farmers' lives are livelihoods are put at risk here. But also, food security is becoming a huge issue. Everybody talks about it, it trips off the tongue, but we need action now, because 50% of the meat eaten in the country is poultry. So the risk here is phenomenal, and it is the cheapest, best value meat on the market by a long shot. So we spoke about food inflation earlier this year, and if you took poultry meat out of the equation, the price of meat would double or triple. So we need to be supported. We're a very highly efficient sector. We don't get any state funding as it is. We were hit recently in the Finance Act, and that didn't help us in the small print. We need the minister to listen to us and to come up with the goods and put the fund in place.
All right, listen, thank you for your time this morning. Yep, no, I get to you. Thank you. That's Nigel Sweetnam, who's chair of the Irish Farmers Association's National Poultry Committee. Right, moving on here now, could you please give a shout-out to Marion, Stephen and Melissa from It's Melissa from CI Hub Letterkenny with their fundraising coffee morning tomorrow at the Jim Lynch Building in Letterkenny. Charities of Donegal Mountain Rescue and the Donegal Hospice. Good luck, guys. Come out and support. In terms of the high rate of learner drivers or people holding learner permits for long periods of time, a caller says simply the issue here is a lack of Garda enforcement. Hi, Greg. We live in rural Donegal. My son is an apprentice. He needs to be left from the house at 6 a.m. I have other children and a job. How is this doable? It's tough, you know, and I know exactly, I think, what you're referring to there. A caller says many no-shows book tests simply to renew their permit, tying up slots that genuine learners who want to complete the process desperately need. Closing the loophole is right and should free up test appointments over time. Listen, if there's no excuse for it, right? Unfortunately, learner drivers are overrepresented in fatal collision figures. But there has to be enough testers there. There has to be enough slots and all that type of stuff. And if the government are improving that, then we're getting to sort of like a there's no excuse situation. All right, so this is the 9 till noon show here in Highland Radio. We'll be back with more on the programme after we take a quick break. Now, you may have heard that Minister Dara O'Brien, announced the expansion of the Fingal Pyrite Remediation Scheme. So Fingal homeowners get full state-funded support. The state pays, the state delivers the work, families are cared for. Now, you would be very familiar with the situation as it relates to defective concrete blocks in Donegal. And they, although the government would say that the problem is solved, they have a very different experience with the defective concrete blocks scheme. And it should be pointed out, of course, that Fingal, very close to that minister's own backyard. Nicola Byrne joins me on the show now, and her family have been homeless for a month. Nicola, good morning. Thanks so much for joining us. I do appreciate your time, and I'm genuinely very sorry with what you're having to endure.
Thanks, Greg. I really appreciate not only the time to talk to me this morning, but also for empathising with, look, the disaster situation, which is a public health crisis for us at the minute. You know, we're homeless and we're sleeping on the floor of a granny flat at the side of our house, which is also, you know, infested with defective concrete blocks. But unfortunately, it's our only safe haven away from our home that is covered in rodent contamination.
How does it feel when you hear statements like, and it was an interview, I think, with Miriam O'Callaghan, where Dara O'Brien it was said to him, you know, the defective concrete blocks issue is sorted, we have a scheme, and he nodded in approval. And then you hear extensions to the pyrite remediation scheme. Listen, these are our fellow country people. We're delighted for them, right? Don't get me wrong. But how does it make you feel in your situation when things are framed as such?
Look, I watched his, you know, his proud announcement. You know, he was so proud of this, serving his, as you said, his local candidates of his catchment area where he is a representative. But look, he announced the expansion. And as you said, you know, you hit the nail on the head there, Greg. They're pitting us against each other. You know what I mean? We want all to unite together, you know. We're not begrudging those in Fingal who are covered on an end-to-end, 100% compensatory scheme different to ours, you know. But what we feel is it's very unfair and it's very unjust. And not only that, like, it preaches, you know. I'm not going to bore people with all the exact articles, but it breaches articles in the Irish Constitution, which states we all should be treated equally. It also breaches construction products regulations and compliance and EU charters, you know, and the European Convention of Human Rights. And this is what hit home to me with my current situation. So Article 8 and Protocol in European Conventions on Human Rights states protection of home, private life and property. You know, we're failed massively. And I'm sure, you know, like everyone else is, even other homes in, say, Dublin, that don't fall within the remit of the Fingal, you know, redress. This just proved to us they do not care about us. That's all we heard from that. They do not care. And it reeked. I know he mentioned his colleague and he was working with Minister James Brown, but it just reeked of cronyism. Like, Minister James Brown isn't only the Minister of Housing for Dara O'Brien's constituency, he's Minister for Housing for all of us. Why is this not given to all of us equally and fair? And I'll just
You wanted to make that final point. Please do, Nicholas. My apologies.
No, Greg. All I just wanted to say was I'm very aware that in Fingal it's only in the backfill, you know, whereas the rest of us, we could have it in the backfill, we could have it, you know, in the walls, everywhere, you know. And all it is it might be in a different area, but it's the same defect.
I want to emphasize the point in relation to that, because there seems to be a hierarchy of, you know, deleterious materials, but fundamentally it's the same problem. And the government has committed and accepts that this is going to be a multi-annual €1 billion project. It's how you access the scheme, though, and the fairness of the scheme. It's frustrating for people affected by this, because you do have, as you've just mentioned there, and fair play to them, people in one part of the country being treated completely different to others in the likes of Clare, Mayo, where you are, Donegal, where I am. And it doesn't make sense, and it hurts people, and they feel gaslit, and they feel neglected.
Well, I mean, every single thing you said there, checklist, with all the emotions I could feel within not even a day, within multiple times to the day with different conversations I had. And I said this, I brought this to Minister James Brown's office, and I had an email from one of his aides representatives that stated that they cannot help me in my situation or answer me at, you know, they deal with things nationally, and that locally I have to go to my current county council. And this echoes the sentiment you said there, Greg. It said then, following, each county council area handles the scheme as they see fit. Okay? So there's no equality and transparency. So it just so happens what each person, and this is common amongst all, you know, in the redress chat groups, every person, it's a postcode lottery and how you're dealt with in the scheme. You know, and as you can tell by my accent, I'm a Dub originally. So would I just have been luckier for this to happen to me if I still lived, you know, in Dublin and was in the Fingal catchment area? Am I unlucky now that I moved up to Mayo, you know?
Yeah. Where are you at? I'd be very familiar with the defective concrete box scheme here in Donegal and its processes and who's in and who's out, and, you know, whether or not you can actually complete your property within the cap, etc., Nicola. But what is the situation for you in Mayo? Were you accepted onto the scheme? Will you be able to rebuild your house through the scheme? So what is your situation down there?
Well, Greg, you know, we, first of all, when I found out that we had defective concrete blocks and I need to apply for a bigger scheme, I was met with the devastation news that because I bought after 2020, legislation will state that I don't qualify for redress grant. However, I didn't accept that. There's no way I was accepting that. I didn't want to. There was no way. I dealt and liaised with the defective block team in Mayo. We have one person here in Mayo who is heading that. And, you know, that's difficult for her. This is ridiculous that alone one person handling this. And she advocated on my behalf, and I had to prove my case. So then this, you know, myself and my husband became almost, you know, lawyers, you know, proving our case. We had to provide detailed property folio of the sale. And we also had to provide accounts and letters that stated and proved. And we also had an engineer's report done internally and externally, which said, oh, it's all superficial, you know. Now, I know an engineer's report is a BCA report or core testing, but you can't core test every single house you view. But what you do do is, when I had that engineer, I expected him to say, well, look, I feel this might warrant further investigations. But he stated that there was nothing he felt was progressive. So on to the story. I had to wait for, I provided them with that, and then it took 5 months. So, and again, I'll refute, it wasn't the person who handles with defective blocks in Mayo. Unfortunately, it was out of her hands. She had to send it on to their legal. So that took 5 months. 5 months I had to wait there, biting my nails, wondering how, you know, we're not going to afford this. So then I got the letter back to say that, you know, we felt you met in good faith. However, so we were... There was a slight bit of joy there, but then the tone changed again. However, we note by the engineer's report that you have, our children have complex medical needs. Some are autistic. They're all autistic, as am I as well. But our children also have heart issues. So they're cardiologists. We have to have a sensory room and like a mini home gym to do regular therapies for our kids. And that's what's up in that attic. And also the other room is an office because we have to work at home being full-time carers. They said to us, you need to go, before you can go on to the scheme, you need to go and get retention for that space. And I said to them, this is going to cost a couple of thousand and delay me another 3 months. I won't do that in the floor space because we're not going to be able to, in any way, max cap of 462 is too short. And anyway, we're looking at hundreds of thousands shortfall. And they said the same to me again, we have to go back to legal. So that's where I'm at. I have a full BCA report stating threshold. I can't do
what a nightmare. It's just, I mean, you have to be an engineer, you have to be a campaigner, you have to be a lawyer, you have to be a mum, you have to be a carer, you have to be a worker. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible burden, but it's a very familiar story here. One question, Nicola, if you don't mind me asking, and this is not as a criticism to any other arms of the media, but we've covered this story right from the very beginning, really, and, you know, we discuss it regularly with people like yourself, but also those behind sort of campaigning in Europe, the science, etc. Is it a big story in the Midwest? Is it a big story in the media, in Mayo, radio stations, newspapers, etc.? And as I say, I'm not trying to set you up to be critical, because maybe it is, but I'm just curious, because I would hope that people up here know that, you know, they've got this platform of this program and hopefully it can make a difference here and there. I'm just wondering what the situation is like for you down in the Midwest.
Well, actually, I think that's brilliant to bring this up. It's an important one, and it's one that's very frustrating. And the meeting we had last night in Ballina, you know, many echoed this sentiment. Obviously, to us, first of all, I want to say, It seems to be a media blackout. Yourself and Highland Radio have been very good in highlighting this plight, and we also have some local reporters with the Independent. Oisin has been very good in sharing my story. He for the Irish Independent. But other than yous, I constantly bombard. You know, not only to that hat that you said, all those different jobs that I had to be. You know, I had to be a news correspondent, you know, because I mass send out media emails pleading with people, you know, to give this more airtime. And I did speak with researchers on Liveline. I haven't heard back from them, and I urge them, you know, for them to keep the national airwaves.
I would have a little bit of an insight into their position on this, and that it's been covered extensively elsewhere in the news section of RT, so wouldn't hold your breath there. I just think it's very important, and I don't want to be preachy, and we don't get it right all the time, but it's very important that the media understands what its actual role is. We aren't PR companies for the government or for organizations or for builders. We're here to sort of cover the stories, hold people to account, and, you know, back the people when that's required as well. So sometimes you wonder if the media is its own worst enemy. Nicola, listen, I hope things improve quickly. I know you're not going to take anything lying down, that you're going to keep advocating for you and your family, and I just hope you get some sort of a respite from what you're going through soon, and you can retire from some of those roles we discussed. But it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks a million, Greg. Thanks for your time.
Look after yourself. All right. That's Nicola Byrne, who's down in County Mayo, with a very familiar story to us up here, of course, and a lot of people listening to the show it will resonate with. You know exactly what she's going through down there, because there's so much of those... that crappy stuff in our blocks up here. Joined on the programme by Karen Porter. Karen, thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you're well.
I'm here, Greg. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Karen.
Good morning, Greg.
You've been really through the mill lately, Karen. I just want you to tell your story, if you know what I mean, because your words will frame it far better than I could with questions. So what is the situation?
Well, I'll keep it as brief as I can. Greg, this has gone back almost 11 weeks now on the 23rd of August. It was just a normal Saturday late afternoon at our home here in Inishowen, and we were at home here ourselves, and my husband, Cahill, and our eldest son was out in the shed doing normal father and son things, you know, on Saturday. And I was inside myself and my other son, you know. So after a short time, I was in the kitchen myself, and I noticed some cattle had broken out. There's actually a lane beside our home, you know. And so I went out to say to our son, Dara, that the cattle had broken out. They belonged to a neighbour. So that was fine. They had actually were heading down, you know, along to go out to the main road, you know. So my son then went over and he went over to help the neighbour with the cattle and send them back down to the lane that they'd come out of. And in the meantime, my husband must have as well headed over to help. And there's just a small gate between our home and the lane. And he went down the other end to help as well. So after a very, very short time, it felt like a few seconds, to be honest, our son was heading down with our neighbour to put the cattle back in where they belonged, and the cattle wouldn't go any further. They had just stood in the middle of the lane. They weren't anywhere. And my son ran down to see, and he noticed that my husband was lying face down in the lane beside our home.
How quickly things can change, Karen. And you don't really know at this point, do you, what led to him being found
whether it
was a fall or a turn or a cow or whatever it might be?
We're not sure. Yeah. No, we're not actually sure what happened, but we immediately got in contact with the emergency services, and I have to just basically be really grateful for them and, you know, the quick care professionalism that we received from them. You know, they were very, very quick, and I'd just like to thank them personally myself.
It's amazing, and it's a reminder to us how quickly life can change. You know, you're probably thinking about something that evening or watching a film or whatever, and next thing you know, fast forward 11 months, he was taken to Bowman, put in an induced coma. You've got him closer to home, but you're still quite a distance away, and you're trying to balance everything, you know, your life,
your
bills.
Your bills, your family, and, you know, we've three children ourselves, you know, and we have twins who are 18, and then we have a 13-year-old son, and he was actually due to start the local secondary school on the Tuesday, which was 3 days, you know, after the accident. Cahill's accident was the Saturday, so our son was due to start first year in secondary school, so it was a very challenging time. I was in Beaumont myself with Cahill, and I travelled up on the Monday night so I could be with our son on Tuesday as he started school. So it was quite an emotional and it was very, you know, trying time, but with strength and with with help from family and close friends and everything, you know, we couldn't have done it without them, you know.
Is that what keeps you going, Karen? I mean, there's a strength. You obviously have an inner strength. I mean, you're amazing with what you've done, and he's so lucky to have you, right? But where have you got this? I mean, we know the support is there, but where have you got this strength in yourself from?
I don't really know. There's days sometimes I wonder, you know, how I got through things. And I look back and think, I don't know how I came through it, but at the same time, I just feel I have to keep going just to get Cahill better, to get him back here to us, you know, as soon as he possibly can. And just, I have to be here for the children, and I have two going to college, and that I have to keep supporting them every way I can as well, and be the best mother that I can be, basically.
Well, it's obvious they're very, very lucky to have you. There's just no doubt about that. How is his recovery going now in rehab in Letterkenny?
Yeah, he's doing quite well. I mean, I can see he's making progression every week, you know, and that definitely is small steps, but we're very grateful that we still have him with us and that things could have been a lot worse, Greg, you know, and I just feel very thankful, and I just think that life is so precious, you know, and I'd like to reflect on our journey, reminded that, yes, indeed, life is full of ups and downs every day, but with hope, love, support, you can get through anything.
Right, if you need anything, will you be in touch, will you? If there's anything, any help I can give you, or if you're planning anything, or, and I don't know, anything at all, will you get in contact?
No, I mean, I will, surely. No, I just wanted to, it was really, you know, to come on and thank especially the emergency services and all the hospitals and staff, and especially our own two families as well, who've been, you know, great support every way. I mean, they dropped everything and just rallied around to help, which is just... means so much to us, you know, and we can't thank them enough, especially neighbours,
well,
friends, family, everything, and work colleagues as well. So,
okay, well, look after yourself, please, and pass on our best
all
wishes.
All right, Greg, thanks very much. I will.
Fair
thank
play
you
to
now.
You. All right, lovely stuff. Thank you
all
very
right,
much
thanks,
indeed.
Greg.
Okay, bye bye.
Bye bye, Greg.
All right.
Bye bye.
We'll be back with more after, we'll be back with news, in fact, after the break.